The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. 25 years ago, I interviewed a guy who came to Yellow Springs to talk about a companion book to a PBS series that had previously been a documentary film, and his name was Jack Duvall. It was called A Force More Powerful, and Jack gave a great interview that day as we talked about conflict resolution and nonviolence, and how we really need to try to address conflict without violence. And I think this is a wonderful interview to listen to now, as we're seeing a lot of conflict and a lot of violence in our world. Let's listen.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And joining me on the program today is Jack Duvall. He and Peter Ackerman are the co-authors of a book called A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict, and he was also the executive producer of the television program you probably saw recently on public television. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Jack, first of all, before we get into the actual subject, I have to wonder, how did you get into this?
Well, my business for a number of years has been developing documentary television programming, although I have a prior career as a writer and in government. But Peter Ackerman, the co-author with me for this book, A Force More Powerful, and I were in touch as old friends at the time that he came out with a book about 7 years ago entitled Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, The Dynamics of People Power in the 20th Century. And Peter had a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and had spent a good deal of his life studying certain nonviolent resistance movements from a strategic point of view. The book that he wrote 6-7 years ago, which was which I read and which he asked me if I felt could be adapted to documentary television programming, was a book that was intended primarily for an academic audience. I felt that there were strong stories within it. I recruited a filmmaker by the name of Steve York, and the three of us developed this project to create this 3-hour television series for PBS, which was aired last month primarily, though it will be re-aired by affiliate stations around the country in the months and years to come. And then Peter and I wrote the companion book for the PBS series as a book that would be a somewhat more comprehensive, hopefully definitive account of the major nonviolent movements at the national level in the last 100 years that used nonviolent sanctions to seek democracy, to overthrow authoritarians, to deal with military invaders, and the like. And that's how this came to be.
I was not cognizant of the fact that this type of approach was really not used very much before 1905. I learned this in the book.
Well, there were no good examples of mass movements prior to the 20th century that were in opposition to some kind of system or regime that denied people rights, that used nonviolent action as a method to force change. Only within the last 100 years have these mass movements really systematically begun to use these kinds of nonviolent sanctions, which we discuss in the book. The 1905 conflict that you mentioned took place in Russia, and in fact it was in St. Petersburg in January of 1905 that the last century's first use of the mass protest march occurred, when Father Georgi Gapon organized as many as 100,000 workers in St. Petersburg to march on the Winter Palace and try to present a petition to the Tsar. There was a bloody crackdown that day on those workers. Many lost their lives. Much of Russia was outraged as a result. The Tsar lost legitimacy. A year-long sequence of events began, which culminated in a general strike in October of 1905, which brought the country to a standstill and essentially forced the Tsar to go along with the creation of the country's first national legislature, the first Duma, the following year. So it was, up to a point, a successful use by virtually an entire civilian population against its autocratic ruler. And at that time, the movement was being covered by newspapers all over the world. And who should it be sitting as a young lawyer in South Africa but Mohandas Gandhi, who read the London newspapers about what was happening in Russia. And he felt that the use of what he called non-cooperation was something that would work to advance the rights of Indians struggling for political, certain forms of political rights in South Africa, as well as ultimately back in his native India.
And ultimately, Mohandas Gandhi moved back to India and took these ideas with him. We see from reading the book and from what you put into the television documentary that Gandhi was a very intelligent man. The way that he approached the situation in India, he looked at a country with, 350 million residents and how many British soldiers keeping them in line?
Very few British soldiers, of course. The way the British Raj held India was virtually entirely through the cooperation of Indians themselves, Indians who served in local police forces, local administrative officers, tax collectors, you name it, any aspect of running a country at the local or regional level really was manned by Indians. And Gandhi said at one point, the British have not taken India, we have given it to them, and we can take it back, he therefore implied by that statement. And one of Gandhi's central insights, political philosophical insights, one might say, was that power did not really consist in the threat of coercion against someone, but rather in their consent or acquiescence to that posed or pretended authority. To the extent that the people decide they will not give their consent or acquiescence to a ruler, that ruler can no longer exercise effective power over them, except to the extent that he can try to use repressive violence, and even that apparatus of repression is subject to the collaboration of a certain number of people within the country who are agreeing to carry out that ruler's orders or that regime's orders. And breaking that kind of collaboration, even the inner circle's collaboration apart, is what many nonviolent movements have done during the course of the last 100 years, most recently in Serbia.
Very recently, too recently to even make it into the book, that particular portion of the story. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you watched that closely. My guest is Jack Duvall. The book is A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict. He wrote it with Peter Ackerman. We look at the genius of Gandhi picking on the salt tax. This was truly a work of genius.
It was. It demonstrated that Gandhi understood that no movement to dislodge an unresponsive or undemocratic power could be successful unless that movement broadened itself to enlist the sympathies and the support of a very wide cross-section of society. And to do that, the injustice of the form of rule needed to be dramatized and brought home to that wide cross-section of people, most of whom would be politically disengaged. Thus, it was necessary to identify an issue that had social and economic ramifications as well as just some sort of political import. The salt tax, the monopoly that the British held on the manufacture and sale of salt in India, was perfect for Gandhi because it fell proportionately most heavily on the poorest and was least defensible in the case of its imposition on the poorest. But even the poor could disobey that that law by making their own salt and refusing to pay the tax on salt. And when he marched to the beach at Dandi in order to be able to break that law by illegally manufacturing salt, he physically engaged in an act which tens of millions of Indians could emulate directly. And that physical act was also an act of civil disobedience against the British Raj, and at least symbolically challenged the economic interests of the Raj.
What's your purpose in writing this book and doing this series?
To be able to amplify on a worldwide basis the cumulative understanding of how nonviolent action is effective. Not only that it has been effective on a number of occasions, which is itself an important message, which too many people in the world haven't yet absorbed, but also how it is done. Jim Lawson, the leader of the Nashville Student Sit-In Movement, whose work we chronicle in both the book as well as the PBS series, is a gentle critic of who he calls nonviolent people. There's one interesting moment in the film in which he says, the trouble with nonviolent people is that, then he makes a criticism of people who are otherwise attracted to the use of nonviolence. And I think it should be clear after absorbing this book or seeing the television series that adopting a preference for nonviolence for its own sake does not necessarily make the use of nonviolent sanctions effective. What's really going on when one is using nonviolent measures is a conflict. One is choosing to fight an authority or a system or a source of injustice or something that is wrong, which is otherwise not being responsive. If there's a democratic system, it's not being responsive through the existing political system, or if it's not a democratic system, by definition, it's not being responsive to what the people would like to achieve or to what a minority, which is being unfairly suppressed, would like to achieve. So as Bernard Lafayette, another of the African-American students who participated in the Nashville sit-ins and who is still active to this day in teaching and advocating nonviolence, said, we were warriors. This was a fight. Most of those who engaged in these nonviolent campaigns and movements understood that they were challenging something that was the most vital thing to the systems they were going up against, which was the very power they held. And that would require a long protracted struggle, as indeed happened in most of these cases. That would require a very shrewd assessment of the opportunities for taking action, the forces that would have to be challenged, and it would not be possible generally to prevail unless there was a clearly thought through strategy for engaging in a series of tests, not so much tests based on physical force, but based on the underlying equation of power, which goes back to Gandhi's basic idea, which was that the real power always lay with those who would otherwise give consent or acquiescence to the authority. So that, you know, one of the first things to do is to challenge the legitimacy of the authority. That's the first thing you've got to do in order to pry away the consent or the acquiescence of the larger passive group who are otherwise letting that unjust authority sit there.
In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook. My guest is Jack Duvall. He and Peter Ackerman have written a book called A Force More Powerful, A Century of Nonviolent Conflict, also a series by the same name on public television. I was fascinated by the Danish resistance to the Nazis. This was intriguing to me, and it's a story that I don't think many people know.
It's not a story which is as well known as the stories of how the Allies engaged in a war with Hitler's Germany in order to defeat it. But the stories of nonviolent resistance to the Nazis in World War II are important not only because of what they accomplished on behalf of the popular societies, which were being suppressed by Nazis through military occupation, but also because these stories help to answer the question which those who are proponents of nonviolence always face, which is, oh, well, it's all very well and good to be nonviolent against a system like the British or the American system during the civil rights movement. When you go up against a really brutish and totally totalitarian regime like the Stalinist regime or the Nazis, clearly you don't have a chance, right? Well, no, wrong, in fact, because there were nonviolent resistance movements which were extraordinarily successful in certain kinds of engagements under certain circumstances against the Nazis. The Danes, at the outset of the German invasion, first of all, had no chance to really oppose the Germans militarily. Their military was absolutely inferior. And they chose not to put up a military fight. The government originally engaged in a bit of a dance of outward collaboration while it tried to preserve as much of Danish cultural and national sovereignty as possible under the circumstances. Ultimately, that proved an untenable strategy. And out-and-out resistance, primarily underground resistance, took hold after a year or two. Much of that resistance initially was violent in the form of violent sabotage directed against both economic interests, which is to say factories that were manufacturing munitions and war material for the Germans. But when there were very serious reprisals against Danish civilians for that violent sabotage, and when instead the Nazis were set back and in fact kept off balance by nonviolent strikes and other forms of nonviolent action, the underground began to emphasize to a larger extent the nonviolent resistance to the Nazis, which became the primary way in which Danish civilians opposed the German occupiers. The greatest story, of course, of the Danish resistance to the Nazis was their success in getting all but a handful of Jews, Danish Jews, out of the country. There was a brief advance warning of an intent by the Germans to take the Jews of the country, Yom Kippur. And Danish civilians almost spontaneously rose up to take Danish Jews into their houses, disguise them, get them out of the country by getting them secretly to ports and beaches where boats took them to Sweden, which was neutral during World War II. It was really an act of collective valor on the part of Danish civilians and gave thousands and thousands of Danes a direct sense of participating in the struggle. And that helped to galvanize the nonviolent spirit of the resistance as well as demonstrate that there were ways, active ways, of opposing the Germans other than by throwing a Molotov cocktail or trying to blow up a railroad track.
That was an incredible story, and they had so many wonderful ideas, like the one where they decided that at noon they had to go work in their gardens. That was so clever.
Yes. Well, the story behind that is that, or the context of that is that the Germans, in order to try to prevent agitation and strikes on the part of Danish workers, imposed a very early curfew on Danish civilians at one point, requiring everybody to go home at 6 o'clock and stay indoors. And so workers at the Burmeister and Wayne shipyard decided one day that because the curfew prevented them from tending their gardens in the evening, they would go home at 12 o'clock to tend their gardens, insisting that it was not a strike, that in fact all they were doing was taking an extended period of time in order to do the necessary gardening that had to be done. And that caught on in the ensuing days, and others decided to take basically engage in a gardening walkout rather than a quote-unquote strike. But there are really, if there is no end to the human imagination, there really is no end to the ways in which various kinds of nonviolent sanctions can be applied. Gene Sharp, who is probably the father of modern strategic nonviolent thought, is now a senior scholar with the Albert Einstein Institution and is responsible for a wonderful document they have, which fits on two sides of one sheet and it lists 198 different nonviolent sanctions that it's possible to take. So we're not simply talking about a handful of things, and we're certainly not just talking about protest marches, which is what the apparently the only thing the broadcast media seems to understand when it hears the word nonviolent action. When we had our Washington premiere event for the PBS series a few weeks ago, we were fortunate to have present on that occasion Lech Wałęsa himself, the leader of Solidarity and later president of Poland. We even begin the book in the introduction with an anecdote that Wałęsa shared with us in our interview with him, both for the book and the television series. He recounted to us the experience he had when in December of 1981, the Jaruzelski regime imposed martial law and arrested all the top leaders of Solidarity when they were engaged in a meeting in Gdansk, back in Gdansk. This was after 16 months of open organization and rousing success in building Solidarity as a mass movement in Poland. And while to the untutored eye, perhaps to the CNN eye, one might say, if I could put it that way, the imposition of martial law would be a form of defeat. Wałęsa said that when he was dragged away by the Zomo police, he yelled at them. He said, in so many words, "You idiots," he said, "at this moment, you have lost. You have driven a nail into your communist coffin, and you will come back to us on your knees." And 7 years later, General Jaruzelski, unable to control strikes in the country, invited Wałęsa and other leaders of Solidarity to a roundtable in Warsaw, which eventually led to a reconstitution of the Polish Republic and elections which Solidarity won. Much had changed between 1981 and 1989, 1988, 1989, of course, but nevertheless, there is a certain sense in which Wałęsa was an accurate prophet. The regime came back to him on its knees. But why did he have that sense at this moment that he was being dragged off to prison? He said, "At this moment, you lost," because he understood that at that moment, the regime realized that it had nothing left in the way of legitimacy to pretend that it had, that it could rely only on the use of violent repression, and that at that moment, that would be visible to the entire nation, and that no consent or active acquiescence even to what that regime wanted politically would be possible any longer from the Polish people. The masquerade had completely ended at that point, and that all legitimacy had transferred to Solidarity, even though from that point forward it had to go underground. When Wałęsa came to our premiere event in Washington, it's the first time that I had met the man, and he doesn't speak English, so we had to speak through a translator. And he's a querulous and, I would even go so far as to say, disputatious kind of guy, which probably is why he was so effective in those negotiations with the government during the strikes at the Gdansk shipyard. And there's a certain sense in which he is rather uneasy being, he's willing to embrace the notion that Solidarity and the change that took place in Poland had a world historical importance. He's also willing to embrace the idea that his movement in Poland and other movements in the 20th century, including Gandhi's, had certain things in common in terms of the form of struggle. But he's very uncomfortable being grouped with heroes who some quick retrospective glance back at history would assume had waved a magic wand and everything had been changed. He feels passionately that it must be understood that the movement which he led operated under the chanciest of circumstances, had as its opponent not simply a communist regime in Poland, but also one half of a nuclearized world, and that the that what he had and his supporters needed to do was to proceed with the utmost scrupulous care in choosing moments to challenge that regime in ways that would open up space for opposition, open up the opportunity for democratic and free expression, but never trigger a wider conflict that could capsize what they were trying to achieve. And the glib assessments of the inevitability of it all really rankle with him, because he went through it day by day and month by month and understood that it was step by step. And that is the kind of struggle that we portray in conflict after conflict, in chapter after chapter, in this book of Force More Powerful.
Jack, I see in your resume that you were a presidential speechwriter. Who are some of the presidents that you wrote for?
Well, in fact, I never wrote a speech for a president. I am one of those speechwriters who had an unbroken succession of losers to write for. And I did write one speech for Bill Clinton once, which he was quite happy with, but this was before he was elected, so it doesn't count, I suppose.
Okay.
I can preserve my record of having written speeches only for losers up to that point in time.
Was Mike Dukakis one?
Dukakis was one. Gary Hart, Walter Mondale, Hart before the Democratic Convention in 1984, and then Mondale after the convention before the 84 general election, and then Dukakis in 88, and then, as I said, one speech for Bill Clinton. Clinton was a guy who, unlike most of these other candidates, virtually never gave a set piece speech with a prepared text. After a certain point in the early point in the campaign in 1992, it would be flip to say that he winged it, but he didn't need watch a text roll up on the teleprompter.
He's that good.
Yes, and we don't seem to be meeting his like again, at least this year, at least in that respect.
I've had Gary Hart on this program, and here's a man who I think he was a sacrificial lamb in a way for the new kind of politics, the new kind of scandal and exposure style of politics. Here's a man who really has something to say, who was so discredited by one incident that no one listens to him anymore.
You're right. There's no question. The Donna Rice episode made him an object of humor on the late night shows. And when you get that treatment, you really can no longer, at least at the highest level of popular discussion, retrieve your credibility, although perhaps in policy circles you can. He's still a very interesting thinker.
Very articulate man. Well, Jack, it's really a pleasure to meet you, and just a treat to actually have you here in studio.
Absolutely. Mine too.
That was Jack Duvall, recorded back in 2000 here in Yellow Springs. He had come for a conference, and you heard it on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. And I think that's a powerful interview, a powerful book, and we need to find ways to resolve conflict without violence. I really think that's important. Thanks for listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and hope you have a great rest of your weekend. I'm Vic McCunis.